Okay, well, everybody, welcome to the September call. So good morning if you're on the West Coast, good afternoon if you're on the East Coast, good in between if you're in between to some of our European groups, good evening. For some of our African groups, good late evening. And for Australia, good early tomorrow morning. So welcome, everybody. I do want to mention that this is the last time that we're going to be using this conference line. We'll be transferring over to Zoom next month, so you'll be able to see the speakers starting next month. And for those of you who have been encouraging me over the last couple of years to upgrade our platform, just want you to know that your encouragement paid off, and I always considered that encouragement to be extremely loving and positive. So we'll be upgrading our platform next month. For those of you who have not met our good friend Bob Inglis, I'm so excited to have him back today. You know, we first met Bob in 2009 when he had introduced the Raise Wages, Lower Carbon Act of 2009, and we were very excited about it. Before we actually went to his office and met him, there was an interview that I read with him in the Miami Herald, and the reporter for the Miami Herald asked Bob, how could a member of Congress, a Republican from South Carolina, from the most conservative district in South Carolina, introduce a carbon tax? And Bob said, if you're not going to do the right thing, you should go home. And that was just game over for us. You know, we're always looking for climate heroes in this organization, but Bob has always been there from that moment on, and even has just continued to expand that since then. Bob, one thing that I do want you to know is starting on October 5th, we are starting the Southern Energy Freedom Tour. And in 22 days, we're going to be in 22 cities in Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and Florida, and doing our first Group Start workshop in Jackson, Mississippi. So we're very excited about the progress that we're making in that specific part of the country. I mean, we cover almost every congressional district now, but we certainly want to be stronger, a little bit closer to home for you. So one of the things we asked Bob to do today is we want to get into some of the issues as legislation gets introduced and how we support it. But before we get to those issues, I did want Bob to just remind us why it's his contention that a carbon fee or a carbon tax is, in fact, the conservative answer to climate change. So, Bob, it's so great to have you on the call again. Thank you for making yourself available, and welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mark. And I assume Marshall is there with you, and so I want to.
Yep.
I got to start by just telling you how much I appreciate what CCL is doing and the wonderful way that Marshall has set this DNA, this organization that really cares about people. And so it's just it's really neat to have these opportunities that I've had to associate with CCL. You know, most recently with a fabulous tour that Peter Brenn arranged through Texas. We accomplished a lot, I think, in Texas and Houston and Dallas. And so Peter's doing great work there. Before that, I was in Nashville with Francis Mendenhall and family and friends there. And before that, with Grant Couch out in Boulder. And so I've been, it's been a great year so far with CCL involvement. And I want to thank all those people and everybody else that gives us so much encouragement and really makes a difference. You really are making a difference through CCL. So that's not throat clearing. That's not a preamble. That really is a very sincerely held belief that we at RepublicEN.org say that if we could just be like CCL, having that level of engagement and involvement by all those people, wow. So we benchmark and see how well you're doing and wish that we could do as well. So what we do at RepublicEN.org is try to convince conservatives that it's very conservative to act on climate change. So in answer to your question, Mark, it's really quite bedrock conservatism to say that we really want accountability in the marketplace. We want people to be fully accountable for all of their actions, and of course that includes all of their emissions. And the beautiful thing is, if you do that, if you simply bring accountability, then all kinds of blessings flow from it, because then innovation will happen. And this is what conservative economists have long talked about, is the power of price signals, more powerful than regulation, because they price signals act more quickly. And, of course, in order to deal with climate change, we need to be acting very quickly. And so when we empower hundreds of millions of Americans, and through a border adjustment, we'll get into that if you want to, the 7 billion people on the planet through that border adjustment will become involved. Then you have entrepreneurs trying to serve those customers who are moving away from the price signal because they realize, hey, there's a steadily increasing price in carbon dioxide coming our way. That means we can sell the Challenger fuels to people who are suffering with the current emissions from the incumbent fuels. And so it's the power of free enterprise, and it, we know it works. And the good news is there are many progressives who also agree, and across the board in the economics profession, it's hard to find an economist that doesn't agree with that concept of putting all the cost in on all the fuels and letting the market judge those products.
Great. Okay, that's fantastic, Bob. And for everybody who's on the call, I just hope you're paying very, very careful attention to the language Bob uses. We have often taken word for word how he talks about this and written it into our talks, our laser talks, and I think there's a reason he's so effective in communicating, and I hope when you hear words like accountability, blessings, serving customers, that resonates with you in a particular way. Okay, so Bob, one of the things we wanted to get into is some of the, you know, things that will happen. We're working very hard to get legislation next year, and so we want to ask you about some of the things that happen as part of that process. So one thing is, you know, there's going to be key people who are not on Ways and Means, for instance. And how important is it to have people who are not on key committees that will preliminarily deal with legislation write to the leadership of those committees about the importance of passing something?
Yeah, but before I answer that, Mark, I got to tell you're giving us compliments about the language you use, but I got to tell you, steadily increasing price on carbon dioxide, I think I borrowed that directly from your materials. So
okay.
So we borrow from each other. That's a good thing.
Yep.
So yeah, it's like this about committee membership. The most direct route to getting something done in Congress is to have people that are on the relevant committees that are jazzed up about your issue. And of course, for us, it's the Ways and Means Committee. And so getting somebody on that committee that's jazzed up about a steadily increasing price in carbon dioxide would be the best thing. Now, all is not lost if our champions are not on that committee, because people have, there are plenty of examples of people doing very fine work that weren't on the committee of jurisdiction. So, for example, my friend Dick Armey, that's a name from the past, did the Base Closing and Realignment Commission as a freshman, and he wasn't on Armed Services. And it's probably the best work he did in the Congress. So yes, best if we can find somebody that's on the committee. But if we can't, it's all about passion. You know, it's like the people of CCL. If you're passionate about something, that passion is infectious.
Great. Okay. And speaking of the champion, what is a, you know, primary or chief sponsor looking at when they decide when they're going to introduce? You know, what are the things that need to happen for them to be ready to do that, and how could we help them with that process?
Yeah, they're looking at they're both looking nationally and locally to set the timing of introducing legislation, right? And so if you're representing a district that, say, is for example, if I should know, but I don't know who represents the district that Elon Musk is making batteries in. But that person has a real local interest and timing, it might be, you know, wow, this is a good time to be talking that, you know. I mean, Elon Musk getting ready to open the plant. That's good timing. And then, of course, they're looking for national timing, too, which is the issue ready to move. And, of course, lots of bills are introduced, even though we all know that they're not going to move in the particular Congress they're introduced in, but you're making a mark and you're beginning the conversation. So timing is everything. And what we have to do is just be in a spot where we're prepared. And then when the time comes right on the national scene, then it comes together. But it's a combination. A member of Congress will introduce a bill based on their sense of what they're trying to accomplish locally or nationally. And locally, it might be tying in with something going on in their district that makes it advantageous for them to be talking about it and to be showing that they're doing something in Washington about it. So, for example, that battery plant, it'd be a good time to introduce a bill if you're if it represents that district. And then you're waiting for the national moment when national consensus is reached.
Right. I know that the earlier comment you made about introducing even when you don't think it's going to pass is certainly what Representative Larson of Connecticut's office has told us multiple times, is that they've introduced bills in years when they didn't think it had a chance to pass, but that's part of the strategy of getting a bill passed is you keep putting it out there and keep making it part of the public dialogue. So we're kind of the anti-lobby, right, because it's all volunteers, you know, nobody's writing checks, but when legislation is introduced that has a chance of being passed, then traditional lobbyists are going to get involved, some of which that would be working in favor of what we want and some working against it. What do you recommend our strategy be with those or groups both for and against?
Well, of course, we do have people that are opposed to us. Anybody that's selling fuels that have a lot of emissions and are experiencing some price sensitivity in their marketplace are going to be opposed to a price on carbon dioxide. Let me be just more blunt. Coal will be opposed.
Right.
But just keep in mind that coal is a shadow of its former self. You know, the market capitalization of coal companies in the United States has dropped 95% since 2011. It's just dramatic what's happened to those companies. And so Big Coal, which had once been very powerful, is now a shadow of its former self. And so they'll be opposed. But the, you know, exciting thing, and this is why I was so glad for, good to go around with Peter Brennan in Houston, because what you're talking there is an ExxonMobil former employee who can speak the language to people in that industry and try to really amplify what ExxonMobil is saying about this. They want a price on carbon dioxide. And so, and by the way, that's because they're going to sell more natural gas vis-a-vis coal. So
yeah,
that's good for them. We're for them. So Mark's like this, some will be against us, some will be for us. But we can't get discouraged when somebody's against us because they have a self-interest that they're pursuing. But we are not without some well-heeled people with self-interest like ExxonMobil.
Yeah, exactly. I was on a panel in Dallas a year ago, and I was talking about fee and dividend, and the next person they handed the microphone was somebody from ExxonMobil and who said, yeah, we love working with our friends at CCL on fee and dividend, which was kind of different than what I think the audience was expecting to hear.
Yeah.
Okay, so then let's talk about the bill process in the House and Senate a little bit. So, you know, assuming we got our proposal introduced in both the House and Senate, so you have a fee and dividend bill in the House, you've got one in the Senate. At some point, they're going to have to reconcile between the two to get a finalized bill to go to the president for signature. You know, how do you approach that process? Do you say, okay, you know, we need to get exactly what we want, and so, you know, we need to dig in on every single thing? Do you assume there's places where you know you're going to have to compromise to get something significant and meaningful done? You know, how do you orient yourself for that kind of process?
Well, you prepare for the long haul, because I would sing it to you, but I remember a cartoon from my youth, and some people on this call may be from my same age, the time frame. The Constitution Rock used to be on Saturday mornings, and they had one about the Constitution. They also had one about, I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. And the next line was something like, it's a long, long journey while I wait here in committee, or something like that. And it's just, so it's a long, long journey. I won't sing it for you, but that's where we are, is it takes a long time to work through the committees and then get to the floor and then get through the conference committee. I mean, just look at Rob Portman's energy efficiency bill, which really should be just so agreeable to just broad swaths of constituencies. You know, it's come to the precipice a couple of times, and now it's in conference. It may actually happen, but you know, of course, if it doesn't happen between now and January 5th or whatever the new Congress is sworn in, it all dies, and it has to start over again. And so I guess what I'm saying is make sure to approach it with patience, but with also, you know, passion and exuberance and pushing forward. It is a long, long journey.
Right. And in terms of setting the stage for a floor vote in the House and the Senate, how much attention, energy, focus should we have on the committee process?
Well, I think mostly what we've got to do is, you know, we all complain about Congress. We say Congress doesn't listen to us, but actually they listen very intently to us. Mm-hmm. And so what they hear us saying, for example, on the deficit is go up there and balance the budget, but don't touch Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, or defense. And so they say back to us, gotcha. You want us to go up there and flap our gums, but do nothing about the problem. We can do that. We're pretty good at that in Washington. Likewise, on a carbon tax, it comes when Congress will act when they sense that people want and need a solution. So here's what I learned after 12 years in Congress. It's a formula that you got to follow. Leadership aimed at consensus plus a crisis equals change. So you have to have this leadership aimed at consensus. That we have not had for quite a while now. We haven't had people focused on consensus. We've had people focused on speaking to activists within their own parties about all kinds of issues, and basically just meeting us in our fears, and occasionally being worst of all, which is driving our fears. So the results orientation, this DNA that I was so appreciate that Marshall set in CCL right at the start, is the way to transform that so that people get, through your activism, members of Congress get reoriented toward leadership aimed at consensus. And then you have to look for some crisis, some catalyzing event that causes people. And I wish it didn't happen to be so. But just the way it is that it has to be, pray not another superstorm Sandy, pray not a financial crisis. It means we got to balance the budget quickly or, you know, take dramatic action to balance the budget. And what better way to do it than to use revenue from a carbon tax while you're offsetting somewhere else? Pray more that it's some kind of an awareness that comes to us that's more gentle, and the most likely, Mark, is a corporate tax reform bill that could move. If you think about it, there are a lot of constituencies that want that. And that might be the most likely vehicle onto which a carbon tax could be attached.
Yep. Let me ask you something about engaging people in this a little bit. So I know that our people are, they're going to do something today, they're going to do something tomorrow, they're going to do it, as you say, with a certain type of DNA that I think is difference making. But how do you encourage other organizations to engage on this issue? I'm speaking at a conference next week, and there's going to be 250 NGOs who we could really help influence on this process. And sometimes it's hard to get past the, you know, people say, well, Congress is dysfunctional, but then they use that as an excuse to not engage. And I don't have any problem with people complaining that things aren't ideal, but not if it's an excuse not to do something. How do you get to people to tell them, yes, I understand that this is not the most healthy Congress we've ever had, but that gives us even more reason why we need to be supportive? What type of arguments do you make there?
Yeah. Well, I think that I remember my friend Ellie telling Eric Cantor, please don't leave Congress until you get to action on climate. And of course, that was such a great way to put it to him. In other words, I care about you, Eric. I want you to do well. You know, that's a completely different approach. And here's what I'd say, Mark, I'm glad you're speaking to those NGOs. Some of them may be from environmental groups. Contrast that with, say, the typical MO of an environmental group, which is basically, Eric, this is what they would have said to Eric Cantor, you are an F. You are a zero. You are one of the dirty dozen. You are on our bad list. We are going to destroy you. Well, now, how interested is Eric going to ever be with meeting with any of those people? You know, what he does is informs up into battle line. And so what a lot of these groups don't realize is that they are driving America apart. It's the CCL orientation that brings people together. So, you know, Ellie saying to Eric Cantor, don't leave Congress without acting on climate, Eric. That shows that you care about Eric. That shows that you want him to succeed. And that's really transformative because it's showing love and grace to Eric, not this zero-sum game of we hate you and we're going to destroy you. You got a sermon to preach there, Mark, to those 250 NGOs.
Okay, good. Hopefully I'll be ready enough to it. Let's get back to the orientation of, you know, the conservative view of dealing with climate change. So we don't hear on a federal basis much about cap and trade as an option, but it comes up on a state basis in some cases, and there's some people who are still kind of dug in that that's the right market way to go, and I do accept that it's a market solution, and I would say if there was never any chance of getting a straightforward fee on carbon, that's our next best option. But can you talk about why you think a carbon fee or tax is so much more efficient and is more serves conservative interests than cap and trade?
Yeah, two parts to that. One is the federal part, and then the other is the state part. It's implicit in your question. So, it's clearly better to act to taking that first, the federal part first. It's clearly better to act at the federal level rather than the state. Although we at RepublicEN.org are supportive of state, we can't weigh in on ballot initiatives because we're 501c3, but we educate toward the end of saying, sure, it's great if a state wants to do something on its own. It's just that you don't get a border adjustment that way. You don't make it so that you get the whole country in on it. And the important thing is to get the whole world in on it. And if we just do this in a state, or bless them that go first, but they lose out to other states that aren't pricing carbon dioxide. So you got to get the whole country in, and you got to figure out through the border adjustment a way of making it in our trading partner's interest to get in on the project with us. Because then we move from hundreds of millions to billions of customers insisting on better forms of energy. And at that point, you have an energy revolution like we had in telecommunications. and distributed energy systems are sold around the world, increase of freedom and mobility, and it's just very exciting. So, but now, on as to why cap and trade is not so good, you know, when I was in Congress, I voted against cap and trade. I thought it was hopelessly complicated, embarrassing the free allocations for the well-connected. It would have decimated American manufacturing. And it was a very large tax increase. And so for all those reasons, I voted against it, but proposed what you mentioned at the outset of the call, the revenue-neutral border adjustable carbon tax. It was called the Raise Wages, Cut Carbon Act of 2009. And so now this is where I need some grace from some of those environmental groups, because what they'd say to me if they were on the phone right now is, you know, Inglis, we went for cap and trade and designed it that way in order to get people like you. You're this conservative who says that markets should work, and that's what cap and trade was designed to do. And so then you stiffed us. You didn't go along with us. And so I need some grace from them because that's some truth to that, that I turned my nose up at their offering of an olive branch, you know, which is here. We'll do it your way. You conservatives did this with George H.W. Bush on acid rain through a cap and trade program. And now we'll do it on carbon dioxide. Your way, Inglis, your conservative way. But here's the difference. Acid rain involved very few manufacturers of the stuff that was causing the trouble. And so all it took was getting those very few manufacturers in the room and saying, here's the cap, now you trade underneath it. That's a very different thing than literally 7 billion point sources, every one of us is a point source for CO2, and saying that now we're going to have to deal with that through cap and trade, I don't think so. I think you need the flexibility and the instancy of a price in carbon dioxide that people can see and respond to. And of course, they've got money in their pocket through the dividend or through corresponding tax cuts that mean that they now have the money to innovate.
Great, great. Well, geez, Bob, we feel so lucky to have you as a partner. Thank you for making yourself available on a Saturday again. You know, every time you're at one of our conferences or on our call, it's incredibly enlightening, and just your manner of the way you conduct ourselves is so inspiring, and, you know, thank you for that.
Well, I thank you. Really, these are not, I hope you know these are very sincere words. Everybody listening on this call, CCL is doing fabulous work, and I hope that you continue to just engage with members of Congress in this positive way. And show other pressure groups, because I guess we're all, I'm part of a pressure group, you're part of a pressure group, but show them the right kind of pressure, which is pressure toward bringing people together and bringing America together. And if I might also give an assignment, Mark, if I could, is if you want to be inspired by all that, Go watch the JFK speech at Rice University, September 1962. If you just Google JFK and Rice, you'll find the speech. It's the moonshot speech. It's 17 minutes of amazing American exceptionalism. And you think about the time period he's dealing with, the dissension that he faced, particularly on things like integration and governors in outright defiance of federal orders. It was not an easy time, but he brought us together with a common threat. And Sputnik was a common threat. Climate is clearly a common threat. It's just not recognized as such yet. But with your work, we'll get there.
Great, Bob. Thank you so much for that. And you might want to stay on for the next couple of minutes just to hear a couple of things that got done since last month's call. I don't want to add in your time, so if you have to drop off, fine, but you might want to hear a few of the things that got done, and then we're just going to go over what we're going to do this month. But again, Bob, thank you so much, and I look forward to revisiting that speech at Rice also.
Whew. Great to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you. Great to have you. Okay, so I do want to go over a couple things real quick that happened since last month's call. I mean, we've made a lot of noise about what happened with the California Assembly and Senate passing a resolution urging Congress, the U.S. Congress, to essentially adopt our proposal. And I just want to give you a little bit of background on that. So that was introduced by Das Williams from Santa Barbara, and that was because our local Santa Barbara people who jumped in there and decided to make something interesting happen. So for those of you in that Santa Barbara chapter who initiated the process, fantastic. On Wednesday, August 10th, there was a Senate Governments and Finance Committee hearing in Sacramento. 35 CCLers made it there for the big day. We had testimony from both Jerry Hinkle and Kathy Orlinsky from CCL, and then all the CCLers got up and stood at the microphone one by one, voicing their support for the resolution. At that point, the chair of the committee actually said out loud, "I love this." And then what everybody said is it was so fun to actually watch democracy in place. So that was one of 67 endorsements that happened this month. But obviously that was a significant one. Just so you all know, Secretary Schultz jumped in and asked a couple of his Republican friends to support it. And three people from our South Lake Tahoe chapter drove 100 miles just to ask their member of the California Senate to support it, 100 members. So if you're one of those three people who drove all the way from South Lake Tahoe, thank you for doing that. And for everybody who in California who worked on that, phenomenal. I mean, let's just keep remembering, this is the sixth largest economy in the world asking the U.S. Congress to introduce and pass fee and dividend. Also, Canada is celebrating their sixth year since the first time a Canadian was on this call. And as of yesterday, we've had in Canada 97 face-to-face meetings with 96 with MPs and one with a senator. Last year at this time, it was 49 face-to-face meetings that happened, so that's just huge growth in Canada. And 6 years when our Canadians first started participating, there was, you know, no thought of having a federal price on carbon, and we feel that we are on the verge of having a federal price on carbon in Canada. So happy sixth anniversary, Canada. That is just outstanding. Also, in the U.S., we published 205 letters to the editor, and that's really, really important. You know, it's not just important that a copy of that always goes to your member of the House and one to each of your senators, but it's important because there are a lot of other organizations who write me every month asking for our numbers because it's what they use as evidence that something is happening on climate change and something can happen on climate change, and you never know who you can reach. You know, as part of that, I just want to read you one short letter. This was Rick Knight, who's our Illinois coordinator, got published in the New York Times, and he wrote in response to U.S. and China set aside rifts for climate accord. He said, "Thank you for publishing good news. Despite recent discord between the United States and China over many issues, we should all breathe a sigh of relief that our joint promise to meet humanity's most daunting challenges remain unshaken. The fact that China's geography makes it more vulnerable than the United States to sea level rise, freshwater shortages, and other dire consequences of climate change may have influenced China's president's willingness to formally sign the Paris Climate Accord. But whatever the motivation, continued collaboration between the world's two biggest economies on the long, arduous transition away from fossil fuel is vital to our future. Let's all work to support these leaders and even go a step further. We need to urge members of Congress to enact carbon dividend policy that will cut our greenhouse gases while boosting the economy and creating millions of American jobs." Okay, here's something that I love about that. I read every letter to the editor in my paper, the San Diego Union, every day. And most of them just have a tone that just rubs me the wrong way. Somebody's always a bad guy. Somebody's always a jerk. Somebody's stupid. And I think that not just being on message, but being on message in a particular way where we're continuing to say, you can do this, and you can do this representing decency and what is best in people, I just wanted to read that as an example of, you know, thank you all. I know there were 205 letters. I bet the other 204 were similar to that, but I liked Rick's on a lot of reasons, so I wanted to read it to you. Also, Australia, not only is Australia on fire with letters to the editor, they got two letters on one day in their financial paper this month. So that would be the equivalent of us getting two pieces in the Wall Street Journal. So congratulations, Australia. That is fantastic work. I also mentioned that Mindy, our regional coordinator from Minnesota, is I think maybe in Montana, maybe a little bit further east, and her bicycle trip from Portland to Washington, D.C. to raise money for for climate. So, Mindy, I don't know if you get to hear the call, but thank you for doing that. Also, starting on, today, it begins our Coastal Roadshow. So if you were at the conference this year, we showed a 25-minute film called Adaptation Now by Diogo Ferreira. And he has arranged, with through a lot of help of ours and a lot of help of you, they'll be doing 82 events between now and November 22nd. And that includes Maine, New Hampshire, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Delaware, Connecticut, Georgia, North Carolina, Virginia, Maryland, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, Florida, and South Carolina. So it's just a 25-minute film. And he shows what's actually happening in Norfolk. So when people think that something's distant, he shows the immediacy of what is actually happening with rising sea levels and then flips over to our conference in the middle of the program. So for everybody who's helping to make that happen, thank you all. That's extraordinary work. Okay. One thing you'll notice if you go to the website today is November Congressional Education Day is now officially open for registration. We called it Lobby Day last year. We're calling it Congressional Education Day this year. What happens in the November event is it's a little bit different than some of the visits we have. So Danny's in the process right now of evaluating all of the meeting notes from the national conference. What we do is go back to Congress and say, here's where you are as a body with respect to dealing with this issue. I think it makes it easier for people to move if they can see a lot of people are moving in the same direction they are. So if you remember 2 years ago, the most commonly brought up issue was what we call China. And in China, we throw in China, job competitiveness, border adjustment. So 2 years ago, the biggest issue was, well, here's why we don't think you can do this. Last year, the most frequently raised issue was the dividend. So it at least seemed that there's some transition in Congress from here's why this can't happen to, well, okay, what would have to happen for it to happen? And by the time we get there in November, Danny will have done a complete evaluation and we'll be able to go in and brief Congress again on exactly where they are with dealing with this issue. So if you're able to come to D.C. this November, you'll be the first group of people briefed on our debrief from this year's Congress. The event is on Monday the 14th and Tuesday the 15th. Monday the 14th goes from 1 to 9. We'll be training during that time with a two-hour break for dinner. If you can make it by noon, lunch is included in the $49 registration fee. And then Tuesday we'll be on Capitol Hill all day and then have a reception afterwards, and we want to see as much of the Congress as possible. So if you're a liaison or an appointment setter, this Wednesday you should get an email asking you to confirm so, again, that we can automate the process, because an event this size we need to automate as much as we possibly can. So please don't respond to that email unless you don't understand how to schedule an appointment. Please respond to the link inside of the email saying, yes, you are, in fact, going to schedule the appointment or not. Even if you're not coming to D.C. in November, we want to schedule an appointment with as many members of Congress as possible. This is going to be a week after the election, and it's going to be our first chance to set the tone for next year. So for all of you who that it works to come, great. It's open for registration now. And whether you're coming or not, we would like you to schedule an appointment. We also got Representative Larson of Connecticut in the House and Senator Whitehouse in the Senate to help us set up briefings. So in addition to briefing Congress on where they are with solving climate change, global warming, we'll also be inviting them to a briefing on the Household Impact Study, and Kevin Ummel, the author of that study, will actually be in D.C. for those briefings, so we're very excited about that. Okay, I want to go over the actions and then talk about laser talks for 1 second. So in Canada, we have a major letter-writing campaign about we do see a federal national price in front of us, and also using every form of social media to encourage our MPs and members of the Senate to act. In the U.S., as we said last month, we're asking you to continue what we started last month, which was working on planning for endorsements and attending town hall meetings and candidate forums. Bonus action, you can write your representatives about the Climate Solutions Caucus. That's the main thing I talk about everywhere we go. You know, people don't think that Republicans and Democrats work together and that we can keep showing, no, actually, we formed this caucus and there's Republicans and Democrats working together. And then the last thing is practice your communication skills and laser talk. I think it's absolutely essential that every month we practice, because we can't get better unless we practice. We can't find out how to say things well unless you say it out loud. And I want to return back to Canada for just a second. You know, at our second conference, we had a pretty good contingent of people that came down from Canada, including Cheryl McNamara, who founded our Toronto chapter. And, you know, lots of times when people come to the conference now for the first time, they're nervous. And I remember being at last year's November lobby day. I was walking there with somebody that was sweating so much, I thought that they might have a heart attack before we got to the first meeting, because it's scary the first time. But what we can always say now is, you know, you're going to be with a bunch of people who've been doing this. It's going to go well. We know what we're doing. We've had a lot of practice. But that first year, it wasn't like that. So Cheryl goes to her first meeting. She's the only one from Canada. And everybody panics, and nobody says anything. So Cheryl starts talking, and she's making sense, and it's going well, and it gets everybody else to relax, and the meeting goes really well. And the thought that went across Cheryl's mind right this is, well, isn't that great? These laser talks actually work. So we do ask you to practice every month, and we do ask you to practice because it's important. And it's simply, it's not probable or likely that we improve, that we get better, unless we do practice. So please make sure that you make that a part of your meeting, whether you're U.S., Canada, Africa, Europe, Asia, Australia, any of the groups that we'll either be calling in live or listening to the recording today.